You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Byron Rustin is not as well known as the other stars of the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, like Martin Luther King Jr. and John Lewis. But as we mark the 50th anniversary of the march, you should keep in mind that he was its chief organizer. He was a fervent pacifist who had advised Dr. King since the Montgomery bus boycott, when he had suggested that the gun in King's living room was not appropriate for a preacher of nonviolence. Byard Rustin lived as an openly gay black man, and he paid a heavy price for that. In 2003, Nancy D. Cates and Bennett Singer directed a documentary called Brother Outsider, which examined the life and activities of Byard Rustin. And on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, their film will be broadcast at 7 p.m. tonight and again at midnight on Public Television's World Channel. It's also available on Netflix. I'm pleased that it brings Bennett Singer to our show today, along with Byard Rustin's longtime partner, Walter Nagel. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Now, Bennett, since the release of your documentary 10 years ago, do you think that people have become more aware of the influence that Byard Rustin had on the history of the civil rights movement?
Absolutely. It's been an incredible opportunity for us to take the film literally around the world, and we know that millions of people have seen it, ranging from middle school students to folks in South Africa to labor groups and peace groups. Rustin's life touched so many different kinds of communities, and every time we show the film, there's this real excitement about discovering what many students call a hero, an unknown hero, and discovering this role model in Rustin.
And now the White House is awarding him the Medal of Freedom posthumously?
Absolutely. All the other six leaders of the organizations that organized the march or participated in the march back in 1963 had already received the Medal of Freedom, and I think it's incredibly fitting and exciting that Rustin will be honored later this year by the president with the highest honor that this country can bestow on a civilian.
Do you think it was because he was gay that he is the last one to receive that honor?
I do. You know, I was just reading a really fascinating piece by Professor Henry Louis Gates from Harvard, and what he writes is, of all the leaders of the civil rights movement, Rustin lived and worked in the deepest shadows, not because he was a closeted gay man, but because he wasn't trying to hide who he was. And I think that insight is incredibly interesting and really provocative. You know, Rustin wasn't trying to hide, and that's what made him a liability.
Walter, who were the greatest influence on Rustin's family and the kinds of things that would have affected his choices as an activist?
Well, I think the biggest influence was his grandmother. She was raised as a Quaker, and part of the Quaker testimony is about authenticity and truthfulness and openness.
Although Richard Nixon was also raised as a Quaker, so that is not a reason in itself.
A lapsed Quaker, perhaps.
Now, he started his career as a singer and sang throughout his life. Was he still singing when you were together?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. He would, in the midst of a demonstration, he would often break into song. Sometimes it was a way of maybe getting over an impasse or a bit of tension in a demonstration, and it would kind of lighten the mood.
Well, he was a terrific singer. And did he ever talk about what might have been if he had just stuck with that?
I wouldn't say he didn't talk about it extensively, but I think he was once he was bitten by the activist bug and the political bug, that was really what drove him.
And Bennett, one of his mentors was A.J. Mustey, the leader of the Fellowship for Reconciliation movement. How did the two meet?
Well, Rustin, in the late 30s, moved to New York and was trying to find a way to channel, I think, his outrage at the racial injustice that he saw and the homophobia and the economic injustice. And the Fellowship of Reconciliation, you know, at that point was a leading pacifist organization. And because of his Quaker background and his pacifist convictions, Rustin was introduced to Mustey and quickly became an ally and a field director who traveled around the country preaching this notion that that segregation was a form of violence, and that it was a Christian mission to address this within the context of the fellowship's work.
Now, Russin also began working with A. Philip Randolph, the leader of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. Did they have a good collaboration?
Yes.
Absolutely. And Walter can fill in on this more, but I think Rustin looked to Randolph as a mentor from the earliest days. And in fact, the two had planned a march on Washington back in 1941, which is important to remember, that movement or that notion of marching on Washington dates back to 1941, when Randolph and Rustin threatened to bring tens of thousands of people to D.C. to protest segregation within the munitions industry and the military. And FDR responded to that threat by issuing an executive order and complied with their demands. So therefore, that march was called off. But from the 40s onward, Randolph and Rustin were really inseparable. And Randolph was the official director of the march, but he only accepted that job on the condition that Rustin would be his, because he recognized, as someone says in the film, that Rustin was the best organizer on the planet. And I don't think that was an exaggeration.
Well, that was before they declared themselves pacifists. During World War II, they refused to serve in the military, and they were punished for it, weren't they?
Yes, yes. I mean, but both Randolph and Musty were part of the peace movement and the economic justice movement. Randolph was more in the economic justice movement and labor movement, and A.J. was a minister, so he was really more of the spiritual side, and Byard was really the person that kind of bridged both of those areas.
Now, was his objection simply that he was a pacifist, or that he also felt that there was discrimination in the military, which as some other African Americans felt, they shouldn't be fighting for a country that wasn't giving them the rights that it was fighting for in the rest of the world?
Well, his objection at that time was really based in Christian teaching and Christian nonviolence. He was very steeped in nonviolent philosophy and Christianity at that time.
So but that was just the first of many incarcerations for him, wasn't
yes.
it?
Mm-hmm.
Did he talk about those experiences with you?
Not so much talked, but there are quite a few letters that he wrote while he was incarcerated in World War II, some of which show up in the book I Must Resist, a collection of his letters, which came out last year. He was corresponding with his partner at that time, and it gives a lot of insight into his experiences. It's not something that we spent a lot of time talking about.
Well, perhaps the one that was most significant in terms of what happened later was the one where in 1953 he was arrested in Pasadena and charged with sexual perversion.
Mm-hmm.
What happened there?
Well, I would say that was very much a low point in Byard's life. He was arrested in the back seat of a car with two gentlemen, you know, very late in the evening and, you know, on, a fairly deserted street. But nevertheless, it was an arrest on a morals charge, and it was, you know, it caused him to be expelled, I guess you could say, from the Fellowship of Reconciliation. And
because he was seen as an embarrassment or would cause him some vulnerability. Well, why did he decide not to be closeted at a time when coming out could really help your career?
Well, my sense of that is it goes back to his Quaker beliefs and this notion that truth-telling and being one's authentic self at any price are incredibly important to being true to oneself. So he did make a compromise, you know, his honesty, his openness, I think he recognized would mean that he would have to take a behind-the-scenes role. But I do think that for Rustin, the payoff wasn't his own aggrandizement, but rather the movement and progress for social change. And so I think his 60 years of activism, you know, proved that one person can make a difference, that change is indeed possible. If you think about where he started in the 40s and where this country is now, or even where it was at the time of the mid-60s, the incredible progress that he helped bring about, I think, really compensated for the fact that during his lifetime he was in the shadows.
There are people who have worked in the civil rights movement who don't see gay rights as being analogous to civil rights in general. Did he see them as connected?
Oh, absolutely, especially later in life. It was really a matter of, you know, what rights do we have as Americans? What rights are we guaranteed in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence? So it wasn't, for him, it was not a conflict at all.
I'm talking with Walter Nagel, who was Bayard Rustin's partner in the later years of his life before he died of what was it, an appendix?
Well, he had a burst appendix, and they operated on him. But two or three days later, he had a pulmonary embolism.
And that was 1987.
Yes.
Also, I'm speaking with Bennett Singer, who with Nancy Cates made a film called Brother Outsider, The Life of Bayard Rustin. It is available on video, on DVD, and you can also get it on Netflix. It'll be shown tonight at 7 o'clock on the World Channel, Public Television's World Channel, again at midnight. I was talking to somebody who'd written a book about Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham, and he said that the King's connection to Gandhi has been exaggerated, it's been part of the myth. But that's not the case with Bayard Rustin, isn't it?
Certainly not, no.
Gandhi was a key figure in the way he saw the world?
Oh, well, the teachings of Gandhi, yes. I mean, he didn't meet Gandhi personally, but when he went to India, I guess in 1948, it was several months after Gandhi had been assassinated, but he'd been invited to come over by Gandhi's son, I guess, at that point.
So when he was talking about the concepts of nonviolent civil disobedience and talking about applying them to the United States, did many people listen?
Well, I would say one of the people who listened was Martin Luther King, absolutely. As you mentioned at the beginning, when Rustin and King first met soon after the bus boycott began in Montgomery, Dr. King did indeed have armed guards outside his home and guns inside his home. And Rustin, as I understand it, sat him down and said, "You can't be the leader of a nonviolent movement and have guns in your house." And King understood that and absorbed that and went on to win the Nobel Peace Prize. So I guess we can debate what, you know, the connections are between King and Gandhi. But I would say that partly because of Rustin's mentoring and involvement, King really did internalize Gandhi's essential notions of nonviolence and then became the leader of this nonviolent movement in America.
Well, nonviolent civil disobedience became a cornerstone of the civil rights movement. Do you think it was more effective in the end than the more militant positions of black power advocates like Stokely Carmichael and H. Rapp Brown?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think now that we're 40, 50 years away from all of these things that happened, I think, you need to look back and see what's been accomplished, and you can point to, specific people or actions that resulted in the civil rights legislation. I don't think you could point to anything that, say, the Black Panthers or some of the more militant. And by militant, we're talking people that were threatening violence. I mean, nonviolence can be very militant. Bayard was militant when he spoke. But I think you can point to a list of accomplishments and progress that have been made as a result of people like Bayard and Mr. Randolph and Jim Farmer and Whitney Young, all of the leaders of the march.
My guess, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and by maintaining nonviolence, I think Rustin and the other practitioners had the moral high ground. If they had picked up a gun, that would have evaporated. So it was that basic insight that you are stronger and more powerful without guns that I think Rustin taught to King and to that the whole movement absorbed.
I'm talking with Bennett Singer, who is a co-creator with Nancy Cates of a film called Brother Outsider, The Life of Bayard Rustin, originally released 10 years ago, now being shown once again because of its significance to the discussion about the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. It will be shown tonight at 7 o'clock on Public Television's World Channel, and then again at midnight. You can also find it on Netflix. Also with us is Walter Nagel, who was Bayard Rustin's longtime partner. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. So let's talk a bit more about the relationship between Bayard Rustin and Martin Luther King. When did their collaboration start? Didn't he help King with edits for his first book, Stride Toward Freedom?
Yes, he did. And Bard was, he ghost wrote the first article that was published by Dr. King. It appeared, I think, in the Fellowship Magazine or Liberation. I think it was called Our Struggle.
Now, I in looking into the story of King and Rustin's collaboration, it strikes me as they had rather differing visions of the future. In 1965, Rustin wrote an essay called From Protest to Politics that argued that the civil rights movement needed to change from a protest movement to a political movement, while Dr. King, I think pretty much to the end of his life, felt that large-scale demonstrations would arouse the conscience of the nation. Did they have a lot of fight over those things?
Not a lot, but I think that Byard understood that once the movement moved out of the South, where blacks really had no political power when it started, if you came up north, there was a black political establishment. It didn't have a lot of power, but it existed. And the politics were different here.
He also wrote that the elimination of segregation in the South would be easy because Jim Crow was already anachronistic, dispensable, and vulnerable, but that the bigger issues that had to be dealt with, full employment, abolition of slums, the reconstruction of our economic system, those could only be achieved through political involvement, and that meant sometimes talking to your opponents. And that gained him a certain amount of criticism, didn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, I think there were times when people thought perhaps he might be too compromising or too willing to talk to the opposition. But, I mean, one of the fundamentals of nonviolence is, being open to dialogue with your opponent. So, I mean, it wasn't inconsistent with that idea. As Byard says in the film, when you're talking about protest, you don't compromise. But when you're talking about politics, there's always compromise involved.
Did he face any personal constraints when he was organizing the March on Washington?
Well, we know that at the beginning, Roy Wilkins specifically objected to having Rustin out front as the organizer because of the arrest and the liability and the baggage that we've discussed. And so the compromise there was that Randolph would become the director, but Rustin would become the deputy. A couple weeks before the march actually took place, Strom Thurmond got up on the Senate floor and denounced Rustin as being a, quote, sexual pervert and a draft dodger, not a conscientious objector.
They also called him a communist or a fellow
traveler.
And
a communist, indeed. He had been a member of the Young Communist League at a time when many progressive people saw the communist vision as one that would help us as it moved toward racial equality and economic justice. But that was a short-lived connection for Rustin, and he denounced the Communist Party in the 40s. But that earlier connection did come back to haunt him, and Strom Thurmond, tried to derail the entire march by attacking Rustin, and it was at that point that King and Randolph and the other leaders said they had full confidence in Rustin, despite whatever baggage he might have had, and I think that was a turning point.
Now, what happened to his work and career after the march? Did he change his direction? Did he see the march as the culmination of a certain aspect of his career?
Well, I think he saw it as sort of a turning point. And the move from protest to political action. He set up the A. Philip Randolph Institute, which was really about economic issues and black workers unionizing, because he saw, that was really the next frontier. You could have the freedom, but if you didn't have the whatever quarter or 50 cents to buy the hamburger, it wasn't a lot of good.
Was he being opposed by people who were leading the Black Power movement?
Yes. And we have a whole section of the film that explores that. For instance, there's a debate between Rustin and Stokely Carmichael in 1967 on black power. There's an earlier debate between Rustin and Malcolm X, separation versus integration. But what I think is incredibly illuminating is that, as we were saying before, these people with different ideologies agreed to come together in public settings and really talk to each other and let the audience think about the vision and the the appeal or the value of each of these philosophies. And I think in this age of polarization, that sort of dialogue is a healthy thing to remember.
Walter, at the time that you met him, he was also involved in foreign politics. What was that work like?
Well, at the time that I met him, he was largely involved in working with refugee issues with the International Rescue Committee. He also was on the board of Freedom House, and, you know, that's a human rights monitoring group and election observing group. So he would travel around, basically either working on relief efforts or looking at possibilities for democratic change.
And he was also engaged more and more in the defense of gay rights. Did he apply the same strategies to gay rights that he had to African-American rights?
At the time that he got involved, I would say no, because I think in this, we're talking about the early 80s, it was really then moving into the courts as opposed to the streets. And so Bard was went down and testified at the city council during the what they called Intro 2 at that time, gay rights laws, things like that, and he would write about these issues and speak to gay rights groups. But he wasn't out marching.
Did it bother him that many people in the African-American community didn't support gay rights, at the same people who were fighting for civil rights?
No, I don't really think it bothered him. I think he tried to convince them otherwise or explain things to them, but it wasn't. I wouldn't say that it was a big issue at that time, not the way that it is now.
How did your life and career change after you met him?
Oh, well, it was like a real sea change. I mean, when I met him, I was going to relocate to San Francisco, and obviously I never got there. I started working with him and just working side by side, day to day with somebody of that caliber and that intellect, you just learn an awful lot. It opens many doors. You meet, of course, fascinating people, a lot of travel. So it really broadened my own horizons.
Bennett, do you think that Bayard Rustin would have been pleased to see that President Obama's speech will reportedly focus on jobs?
Well, I do think, it's incredibly important to remember the unfinished business and to look back at the demands of the march. And how far we've come, but how far we have to go. And I'll just say that at our website, which is rustin.org/100, there's the official organizing manual for the march, which lists the demands, and it was written by Rustin. There's also a really interesting piece called From Montgomery to Stonewall, where he writes about the connections that he saw between civil rights and gay rights. So if folks want to learn more or read about, these issues from Rustin's point of view, I'd encourage them to check out those documents.
Are you surprised or shocked when you look at some of the things that were said in 1963 about the march before it actually took place? One member of Congress said that it reminded him of Hitler's government-sponsored rallies in Nuremberg.
Mm. Yeah.
Now we're celebrating it as one of the most important positive events in American history.
Yeah. Well, people in Washington were terrified of what might happen. The city was virtually in lockdown that day. Of course, all the liquor stores were closed. I think the National Guard and the police forces had started to move in. And, Bayard insisted they be kept on the outskirts of the city and that his marshals, his nonviolent people that he had trained, would handle incidents, within the march itself.
Bennett, just one more thing. The march was called the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Has the jobs part been pretty much swept under the rug these days as we talk about the event?
Well, I think it has been largely until now. I've been encouraged by the media coverage and the way the march is being rediscovered or, interrogated and remembered. It seems to me that the current coverage is really focusing on jobs. And I think in the wake of the Occupy Wall Street movement and this new consciousness of the 99% and the 1% and the economic divides, that is very fitting that the legacy of that event needs to focus not only on civil rights, but economic justice.
The film by Bennett Singer and Nancy Cates called Brother Outsider, The Life of Bayard Rustin, has won 8 Best Documentary Awards and many other awards over the years, the 10 years since it was released. It is being shown tonight at 7 p.m. On Public Television's World Channel, and then again at midnight. My great thanks to Bennett Singer, who is co-director with Nancy Cates, and to Walter Nagel for being on our show today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.